Hey folks, you're listening to a special nine-part series on gender, gender politics, and gender equality. Obviously, you can do what you'd like in terms of how you listen to them, but I've designed these to be listened to in order. Each episode builds on the last one in a logical way. Think of it like you'd think of a book. If you take things out of order, a lot of it is going to be hard to understand or just seem off. So if you've just stumbled into this episode, please go back to the start. Otherwise, thanks for listening to Everything in Order. Let's get into it. Welcome back, folks, and hello again to Emma and Inga.
Hey.
Hi.
Today, I would like to talk about the concept of privilege. And that'll lead us towards what I'd like to term the great gender privilege paradox. And then from there, that I hope will lead us towards something that vaguely looks like hope going forwards. So privilege. I'm not the first person to observe that the lens of privilege is a good one to use when looking at and understanding gender equality and issues, etc., and socialization. I'd like to lean into that today. I think just specifically the word privilege is very politicized. It's generally used in a kind of a whack you over the head with a stick kind of a vibe, as in like calling people out on their privilege, waking people up to their privilege. That's often quite a messy kind of a context, which is a shame because I think it is an awesome concept. It is a really useful tool. So I want to be on the record as saying I'm massively in favour of privilege. That doesn't quite accurately represent me. I'm massively in favour of looking into and enjoying looking into privilege and our privileges, etc.
I'm more like
privileged to be able to do that.
Hey!
Very, very. It's more like a let's explore our understanding and have a discussion around privilege, not use it as a weapon.
Indeed. Yes, indeed. Nice. So I would like to summarize what I think is probably the current kind of generally accepted viewpoint on privilege, particularly as it relates to gender. I'd like to do a bit of a deep dive on how we measure privilege, looking at some of the sort of universal indicators of advantage and disadvantage, or you know, privilege and lack of privilege. And then leading out of that, I would like to explore what I think of as a higher resolution model that I think makes more sense of things, but more importantly, leads us towards solutions and outcomes. And as you know from last episode, we're all about the solutions and the outcomes here.
Always.
Okay, so the standard model, I'm going to call it, teaches us that certain people in this world are privileged in relation to access to resources, wealth, power, etc. And in general, those people are likely to be male, they're likely to be white, they're likely to be moneyed, etc., etc. Just want to declare from the outset, there's nothing about that that I disagree with. I think that is an excellent starting point. But I stress starting point. I think a few things to remember just for later on, once we get into the details, is that one of the things I like about the concept of privilege is there's something about when we talk about privilege, there's almost like an inherent understanding that there's something there that probably needs to be leveled or shared around or made fair.
Inequality, if you like.
Yeah. And inequality needs to be made more equal. Love it. We are, as humans, we are much better at spotting other people's privileges than we are our own. It's just the nature of being human, I think. And also, I think it's worth acknowledging that the process of becoming aware of a privilege of ours is actually kind of painful. There's like some kind of little, I don't know if it's quite like an ego death in there, but there's something about like realizing that something you thought was normal, or maybe even something that you might have had a little bit of pride in yourself around, thinking to yourself, I did really good. I achieved this. When you realize that it's both a question of, yes, it's something you worked for and achieved, and also you're there because of privilege, there's something painful about that. There's something a little bit humbling. Like, you know, my ego sometimes feels like it takes a hit, and I welcome it. It's important work, but yeah.
For sure. Mm. Yeah.
It's almost like athleticism. Like you're born with a level of natural ability to be able to achieve. It's not just all your hard work necessarily. So you're born with a physical advantage or privilege, if you like. So then you then capitalize on that. So what you do with that is up to you, but you're not starting from, you know, backwards. You're starting from very far forwards.
Yeah, I love it. And it's funny, people often draw a distinction between privileges that you've earned versus privileges that you were born into. And it's really funny, when you're the one with the privilege, you're more likely to see it as something that you have earned. But from the outside, we tend to notice more the aspects of that that you're born into. So your example of athleticism and sport is great, because not only do you need to win the genetic lottery to have a sports person-like physique, such as myself, and just natural hand-eye coordination, but you also need to be in a spot where your community or family or yourself can afford to spend those resources to indulge in such a luxury. So absolutely, there's like a whole bunch of societal and structural privileges in there, as well as your incredibly hard, dedicated effort. Like it's all of the above.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, won't be drawing a distinction between earned versus born for today. Oh, I do have another great example, though, that I think really highlights this. Have you two heard about the rigged Monopoly experiment?
No, but I want to do it to people before even knowing what it is.
So I imagine most of us are familiar with the game of Monopoly. Look it up, listeners, if you're not familiar. In the experiment, like, you know how at the start you divvy out the money equally, and I think equally is a pretty important part of things.
Yep.
In the experiment, you give one person twice or 10 times the money of everyone else, and what do you know? That person wins almost every time. Like it's basically a guarantee. But the thing that's – I was about to swear – the thing that is very hilarious about the experiment is you get to the end, and not only does the person that won, when you ask them about their gameplay, et cetera, their strategy, not only do they say, yeah, I think I, you know, played that really well. I handled and managed. I've got some good game strategy here. Not only do they think that they've earned it, but the other players think that they've earned it. Like the other players are inclined to go, yeah, they did really well.
In the experiment, did they all know that one person got more money or not?
They know.
From the start, I imagine.
From the start, they know. They know the experiment they're entering into. And they still tend to assume that, yeah, I mean, if we broaden this out, we overlook the impact of privilege.
Oh. That's perfect. That's a perfect example of just how inherent our biases are in the face of cold hard truth too, which is
it is amazing.
Mm.
Not in a good way.
No.
Okay, so that's kind of some standard model stuff, I guess. I also just want to briefly mention the concept of intersectionality, because we're going to expand on that a little later. So the standard model of the intersectionality approach to gender equality or to feminism is the idea that you have privileges that intersect each other. So the classic example is that a woman with white skin has different privileges to a woman that is a person of colour, is like the classic starting point for intersectionality. That is also very much something I agree with, but also think needs to go a little further. So Let's do a little deep dive on measures of advantage and disadvantage. This has sort of been a little hobby project of mine for ages, as I've been trying to work out what's going on and gender equality and how men and women fit in. And something about the simple model has never felt nuanced or complex enough for me. So I've spent a lot of time over the last, like, I don't know, 20 or 30 years looking at measures of advantage or disadvantage. And as at the time we're recording this, large language model search engines are relatively new. So ChatGPT is relatively new at the moment. And it's been absolutely incredible to go to one of those engines and ask the question. And so I'm gonna quote this so that the listener at home can do their own research and see what comes up. But the question I asked is, what are the standard indicators that show us that a given group of people or a demographic are disadvantaged? So important things there, like the standard indicators. And I guess the point I'm trying to make is that there's actually like pretty rigorous science behind this. It's not guesswork. There are a bunch of standard indicators you can use, and they show you who's in a better position, who's got that double monopoly money, and who doesn't. This will vary over time, and this will vary according to the exact nature of the question you ask. But what's come back to me is nine broad, more or less universally accepted categories that just feel really right to me. And I'd like to go through them in quite a bit of detail. There are also another five just very particular specific things I'd like to tack on, but I just want to stress that's kind of more like my input as opposed to so far what I'm talking about. I'm aiming very much for objective, externally validated, scientifically reasonably rigorous bits of data. So I want to separate those kind of 9 points from the five I want to tack on. I think the five I want to tack on, they're still really good indicators of advantage and disadvantage. But yeah. So I'd like to go through these indicators three times. First, just to have a quick read. Second time around, I'd like to use them as they relate to race relations. And I just want to assure the listener that we're not about to be erasing race differences or racism or those inequalities, quite the opposite. And then lastly, I'd like to go through them in relation to gender.
Interesting.
I hope so.
I am waiting in anticipation.
Okay, so I'm just going to I'll read these through relatively quickly. So first point, income and wealth disparities, which is defined as disadvantaged groups often have lower average incomes and less accumulated wealth compared to more advantaged groups. Disparities in wages, salaries, and access to assets like property or investments can be significant indicators. Point number two, education attainment. So limited access to quality education and lower levels of educational attainment can indicate disadvantage. This can include lower rates of high school or college completion, limited access to higher education institutions, and fewer opportunities for skills development. Point number three, employment opportunities and unemployment rates. And as I'm reading through these, I'm realizing I probably don't need to read the descriptions, do I? I think this is such almost like common familiar knowledge. I'll just try for the headings.
Particularly because you're going to expand on it anyway.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. So point number three, employment opportunities and unemployment rates. Point number four, health outcomes. Point number five, housing conditions. Point number six, access to services and resources. Point number seven, discrimination and social exclusion. Point number eight, criminal justice involvement. And point number nine, political participation and representation. Yenga?
As you're reading through those, I'm looking in that and going, the interconnectedness of those is significant, almost in a escalating as you went through those. So if you start out in an income bracket, in a household that, you know, is of a lower income bracket, lower wealth kind of side, then you have less education opportunities, which leads to less employment opportunities, which leads to decreased health and housing conditions, access to services, more discrimination, yeah, et cetera. So that's interesting that they are so interconnected.
They really are. They really are. Yep. They all relate to each other. And also, if you have income and education, you're probably less likely to have criminal justice involvement, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Love it. So, like, doubles down.
Yeah. Amplifies, exaggerates, builds on itself. Privilege begets privilege.
Cool.
I wonder if we can get begets into every episode.
I know you, Rog. I'm pretty sure you could do that.
I think we did a lot of begatting last time, didn't we?
Yeah. Well, this is, you know, more seriously, this is what we are trying to look at, is how do we get from here to begatting over here? So, absolutely.
We're here to begat the love and begat the privilege.
Totes.
More evenly. All right. So, to that list of 9 points, I would also add supplementary point one, levels of violence. Point two, likelihood of dying in a violent or bloody way. Point number three, suicide rate. Point number four, number of friends. Actually, I'd on the fly like to change that to like quantity and quality of friends. I think that's a more useful metric. And then point number five, happiness and happiness surveys.
Mm.
So, if we think about these in the context of race, I mean, I don't even know to what extent we need to go through these because I feel like it's obvious, but let's have a little pause and think about it. So for the purpose of race, this is almost like a little litmus test just to like test out these measures. And I think just for the sake of clarity, let's think in terms of, say, in the Australian context, let's think in terms of Indigenous Australians versus white-presenting folks, and maybe in the American context, let's think in terms of people of colour, particularly African-Americans compared to white Americans. And also in doing this, by the way, like I just acknowledge that we all seem like we're sort of white or pink presenting people. I just acknowledge that for the listener. So I'll just read through these quickly as we think about them from a race perspective. So income and wealth disparities, we know that white people have more income and wealth. Education attainment, we know that white people are miles ahead in terms of education. Employment opportunities and unemployment rates, we know that that's massively tilted in favour of white folks. Health outcomes, another one for whites. Housing conditions, another one for whites. Access to services and resources. Whilst various services are in place to help start addressing inequalities, I am guessing most people would agree that, generally speaking, access to services and resources is still tilted in white favour.
Yes.
Discrimination and social exclusion. I feel like it's the race relations community that gave us those concepts because we know that discrimination and social exclusion is very negative for non-mainstream races. Criminal justice involvement. We know that people of colour are massively overrepresented within that system. And political participation and representation. I feel like we have a little bit of visibility over Indigenous issues and people in Australia. And I feel like the situation is somewhat better in, say, the United States. But generally speaking, non-mainstream folks are underrepresented.
Yes.
And also on my five supplementaries, levels of violence. We know that there's, thanks to lateral violence in particular, which is probably another topic for another day, but we know that there's higher levels of violence within marginalised or minority community groups, and just to clarify, not their fault, playing out levels of oppression that have been put upon them by the mainstream. Okay, so it turns out we did do a quick little dive into lateral violence. Next point, likelihood of dying in a violent or bloody way, much more likely if you're of coloured skin. Suicide rate, much higher. Quantity and quality of friends, I don't know about that one. That might be our first, that one could go either way.
Yeah.
I don't know how to call it in relation to race. Let's just call it mixed.
I think so, because there's just a difference in how people show up in their communities.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether you'd put family relations in that bucket as well, because that would influence some of those things, but that level of community is very different from a typical white kind of folks.
Yeah, yeah,
representation.
Yeah. You raise a good point, actually, around me going to ChatGPT. ChatGPT isn't actually a god, and they aren't actually an extreme IQ person. They're just a sort of a summary of what's out on the internet. And stuff like access to family, I noticed that too, that actually doesn't come up in any of these measures, and it's not counted as an important thing, which is kind of hilarious, because when you ask people what's important to you, for most people, the most important thing in their life is access to family. And that does have some gender implications coming up for that one, but we'll cross that bridge.
Yeah.
It would. And my last supplementary point is like happiness and happiness surveys. Another one that's like not super easy to measure, but I'm pretty sure that for happiness, you're better off being white. Mm. Actually, in Australia, there can be no question about that. So when we look through these from the lens of race, like we're looking at not quite 100%, but it's almost 100% in terms of who's advantaged and who's not advantaged. Like it's just so clear.
Hey, I hope you're enjoying the series. I do this for the love of it, but there is something I'd like your help with. I'd love it if you can share this with someone. At some stage during this series, when someone comes to mind that might be interested, please go right ahead and click the share button. I'm aware that in some circles this can be pretty contentious material, so here's a tip. You don't have to say, "Hey, I love this, you will too." You can just say, "There's some food for thought here," or something similarly ambiguous and non-committal. It's all good. So yeah, at some stage during this series, please share it with someone. Now, back to the content.
Okay, let's do it for gender. So for me, yeah, here's where it gets interesting. As we go through this, I absolutely promise that we, and I mean all of us, like the three of us, as well as the listeners, I absolutely promise we will disagree on the details. Like it's so easy to get into points of confusion and difference of opinion and looking at one set of data and versus another. So I just absolutely promise. I even know that I'm going to disagree with myself as I go through the process of editing this. And then once I've published it, I know when I listen back, I'm going to be disagreeing with myself. It's just the nature of the terrain, and it's going to drive me nuts. But that's okay. Stick with it. If we have some differences of opinion around some of the details or even some substantial ones, it doesn't matter that much overall.
We can do additional research or acknowledge, hey, we'd actually like to take that topic apart a bit more,
yeah,
actually, because there's a bit more to it. Yeah, we can always do that. Can I?
Yeah.
I'm going to ask another question. I'm going to ask a question this time. How does age come into these things?
Ooh, it definitely does. Can you hold that question for about 10 minutes? Because once we get through looking at these measures of advantage and disadvantage, I want to look in a little more depth around how we look at privilege and defining the word privilege. And one of the reasons I want to do that is because something like age is both a privilege and not, depending on what it is you're wanting. Like if you're wanting wisdom and happiness, then older age is an advantage. But if you're wanting maybe like health and sport and sex or...
It's like a subset of these.
Yeah.
Kind of. So, yeah. No, I'm happy to pause that.
Great. Okay. So starting with the first one, which is income and wealth disparities. So at first brush, it's a no-brainer, and men win in this category, and in so many ways they do. But it is also a little more complicated than that. Like one level of is we know that men earn more on average. They're in higher paying jobs. So yes, that one's straightforward. But it's not quite as simple. Like a lot of people, if you ask them, like, what's the gender pay gap about? A lot of people just off the top of their head will say, well, men get about 17% more for the same work. And it's a lot more complicated than that. It's so much more complicated. And I got so delightfully deep in the weeds about it that we're going to do a whole section diving into pay gaps, wage inequality, the complications of work and so forth. So I'd like to flag that for an upcoming episode. Also, with regards to wealth and assets, I have thought, and it has been for most of my life, a no-brainer. We know that men have got more wealth. However, current research shows that as of this year, women are going to have more wealth than men. Sometime this year, it's changing.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I too was surprised. That is from, if you want to do your own research on that, that's from the Bank of America as the most credible recent research on that. And to be clear, it's great research. So I'm going to kind of notch that up as a win, this general category. I'm going to notch it up as a win for men, but it's not as strong as I initially thought it was going to be, having sort of updated my research a bit.
Kind of makes sense. A little. If I think about the gender pay gap aside, and we'll get into that in a different time. But if I think about the outcomes, so there are more people getting divorced, and in divorces, there is more equality or equity around how things are split from families and things like that, particularly because in general, more women end up with more custody of children and therefore more financial support that way as well. So
yes,
probably makes sense in a way in which why would society be moving, as well as women are getting better educated and therefore in different areas and moving into those areas where they are higher paid as well, and more representation in higher levels of more companies, etc. So
yes,
that kind of makes sense.
I totally wouldn't have thought we'd caught up yet though.
Yeah, I think one of the mechanisms, I think all of what you've described, Inga, is absolutely yes. And I've had a quick look at that Bank of America research just because I was like, come on. And one of the elements is because men die younger, and in a lot of cases so much younger, if they're not divorced, or even if they are, a lot of times there's this massive transfer of wealth.
Yeah,
that happens.
Makes sense.
Yeah. All right. So the second area is education attainment. This one has shifted just so radically over time, and thank the gods for that, because let's face it, back in the time where folks like yourselves weren't allowed to go to tertiary education, your outcomes weren't that great, or even school at all, full stop. And shout out to the cultures around the world where that's still the case.
Yep, definitely.
Just to be clear, that shout out was in sarcastic font.
However, so that was an acknowledgement.
An acknowledgement of a problem that needs to be fixed, yes. However, women are now way ahead, at least in developed nations. And I guess for most of this, I've only got visibility over countries like my own. But yeah, women are way ahead in terms of better enrollments, better completions, better marks, better everything for education. So I'm counting education in our context for women. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one all so far. Third area is employment opportunities and unemployment rates. So, yeah, way more complicated. Got a whole section coming up on it. And I'd just like to handball that to the unresolved or mixed outcome for the moment. Because, yeah, really is a whole deep dive coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm just scrolling down my pages and pages and pages of notes that I made on that one topic before I decided that it needs to be its own episode. The fourth category is health outcomes. So this is another area where historically it may have been different. Like it seems to me that historically the medical system has had more interest in male bodies than female bodies. And there's a little bit of complexity there because some of it's because we had male soldiers and male prison inmates and male asylum inmates to experiment on, and there was less of a sense that we were transgressing their rights when we ran experiments on them. So, like, it's a bit of a funny little mixed bag around some of that, but I think by and large it's still the case that historically the medical system has been both male dominated and more interested in finding out about male issues.
Yes.
These days women have got much better health outcomes than men do. One really crude but effective indicator, as my mate 7 of 9 used to say, is just length of life. Like, it's a really crude indicator, but it is a consistent and effective measure of health outcomes.
It is an interesting one to dissect because, yes, women live longer, and there's stats for as long as I can remember saying similar kind of things, but at the same time, getting a doctor to take pain seriously as a woman is significantly more difficult. Getting, and I'm talking very stereotypically here, getting a man to see a doctor because of their health issues is typically somewhat harder. So it's, you know, yes, I go to the doctor. Will they take me seriously? It's taken me a really long time to convince them to give me stuff that has made my quality of life better, to the point where I now have to unwind some of the problems caused because that took so long. And I know people of a different gender than me get listened to earlier, but, you know, getting them to take their own health seriously, like their own mental health seriously or their own physical health seriously, is harder. So, and that's because they're socialized to, you know, some of the things like suck it up, etc. So it's really mixed in that way. So yeah, but objectively, no, not objectively. No, yes, objectively, it was the right word. If we take how long people live as a really like basic measure, women do live longer. So,
can I ask? This is something I've been wondering about for ages.
Yeah.
Let's just do a little like side mission.
Sure.
How do we know that the medical system is less inclined to listen to the complaints? Not that's not your wording. The concerns of women about their health as opposed to the concerns of men. And I ask because, like, I hear you that you've got an example of that. I do too. I've got chronic fatigue. And the amount of humiliation I received throughout the process of getting anyone to take that seriously is just horrendous. And it's the same as all of my experiences in hospital and the medical system. No, not all of them. There are some spectacular Western medicine people out there. Thank the gods for them. But yeah, my question is just, how do we know?
There's currently a study. Well, not a study. There was currently an inquiry on exactly what I'm talking about, which I contributed to in, I can't remember if it was Australia or Victoria, that is being, wants the stories of women and, you know, AFAB type people.
Just wanted to clarify the language that Inga used there because it might be unfamiliar to some listeners. The abbreviation was AFAB, which is short for Assigned Female at Birth, and it's got a counterpart, Assigned Male at Birth. And that refers to when you are born, the doctor or doctors look at your genitals and assign you, generally speaking, male or female at birth. And it's a sort of a replacement language that is used sometimes for man and woman, the details of which are the subject for another time, but just wanted to clarify that language.
And their experiences in getting medical assistance because it is really difficult to get that. It's worse when you talk about reproductive health
Yeah.
And being able to make your own choices about your own reproductive organs,
yeah.
As a woman, that's exceedingly difficult until you're a certain age, until they think
yeah.
you're old enough,
yeah.
Or you luck upon the right doctor. So it's those kind of outcomes. So it's quality of life rather than length of life. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I have a fun side story on that. So in the study you're talking about that was done recently, I'd still be really interested to know like how they actually make the comparison. Like you mentioned, they asked a lot of women about their experiences, and
yep.
maybe you didn't say it, but maybe they didn't research it, like doing the compare and the contrast between women's and men's experiences, and hello to the other minority genders, which ironically most of us are members of as well. But so I'm really interested in that. And the thing around reproductive choices, I think there's a dynamic that happens when we're looking at health, which is really intriguing. I was listening to a AFAB, so assigned female at birth, friend, complaining about the process of getting, now help me out, is tubal ligation the correct word for when you get your fallopian tubes?
Yeah. Yes.
Tubes tied? Tubes tied. Yeah. Let's go with tubes tied.
Yes. They put little clips on there for you.
And so my friend was having a very understandably passionate rave about their experiences, which is to say, as someone without kids, they went to the medical system and were essentially told by the man, we're not going to let you do that. And they raged and they raved and they said many of the things that you were just saying about that. And so I said to them, yes, I understand what you mean. When I found myself accidentally pregnant in my early 20s, at age 22, I went to my GP to say, I'd like a vasectomy as soon as possible, please. And they said, give us a stat deck from your wife saying that you've had as many kids as you're planning on having, and I'll consider it, meaning I won't consider it. You're way too early. I went back at 32, and I had to lawyer that shit. Like, I had to get so assertive and dominant with them and basically read them my rights. And they finally put me on a really low-grade waiting list, and through a fortuitous set of circumstances, someone cancelled, I got a call, and I got my vasectomy, which they weren't going to give to me. So the story is identical. If you go through that system as a woman and you're looking for the ways that you get fucked over by the medical system, like my friend, you come out of that with the conclusion that the medical system is in favour of men and men's health and everything else, and that you're just a series of being fucked over by the medical system.
Yep.
What I would like to suggest is that when we look for one thing, we only see one thing. And I think a lot of the case, the medical system hates all of us.
I was thinking, I've been a bit quiet with this just listening, but, you know, I've got a lot of personal experience, and I've got a lot of friends I've had friends who have experiences of going, I go and say, I've got this pain in my womb, I've got this pain in my lower belly, and blah blah blah, and then I'm told that it's nothing and all those sorts of things. But I wonder also about confirmation bias, and I wonder about, you know, if I were happened to have a penis and I was going saying, I've got a random stomach or lower belly pain, what is it? And they did test and they might still say, oh, it's nothing, you've got nothing. I don't know, like I can't know because I'm not outside me, and I can't know because I'm also already female, which means my female friends are female, and therefore the confirmation bias is already there. I can't know what it's like to talk to my male friends about being female.
I'm in the same boat. My only experiences going through the system are from someone who is perceived and is male. And I know that, like, the stories that women tell about the ways they get fucked over by the medical system, I relate to every one of them. But it's not science. So all I've got at the moment is the question where we started this little side journey with, which I've been loving, by the way, which is, like, how do we measure that?
Objectively, I think you're right. I think you are correct in that, you know, at the end of the day, men don't live as long.
Yeah, and you're right. We don't reach out for help as well. You mentioned that, and I was chatting with someone else about this somewhat recently, and they took the perspective to say, well, you know, you can't blame that on the system. The services are there, and it's up to men if they take it or don't take it. And I said, can I get you to say that about people of colour?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no.
And they went, fuck you.
Were you right again? Yeah, no, it's and I recognize you know, this is another one where there are certain areas where, you know, women can show up in a different way than men and get different outcomes. And men, you know, may have access to the same services, but it might not be as easy for them to access that or to acknowledge or even to go, oh, that pain's a different pain. I should probably care about that. Or whatever it is, it doesn't really matter. There are definitely bad bits. And then yeah. There's the same bad bits, like you've talked about, like getting a chronic condition diagnosed and dealt with to an extent where you have a quality of life is significantly difficult, regardless of your gender. I would also argue that some of the demographics that we belong to, it's worse because we have to advocate for ourselves in so many other ways, that advocating for yourself with your health on top of advocating for yourself for mental health, you need to prioritize physical or mental health. You can't always deal with both. So we do get worse outcomes because of that as well. So it's a particularly interesting and nuanced space, but health, we let lots of people down very often. So
yeah. Oh, that's so true what you say. It's an incredible experience when you go into to see a GP or something like that, any health professional, and you become aware, like I speak in the first person. I become aware that I look weird and that when they mention my gender, I go like I'm about to say something and then I submit, just go, yeah, sure, let's just go with male, whatever. And then we're talking about something which has got something to do with sex and I'm trying to work out how to describe polyamory. And it just goes on. And over the course of time, sometimes, like, as I say, not all of the Western medical system is like this at all, or the rest of the medical systems. But some of it is just such harsh territory. And yeah, the more minority we are, the more, yeah. Anyway, so we don't know how to measure that one. I totally agree with you. It's like, yeah, could be either way. There's that crude integrator of length of life and a couple of other ones. So I'm kind of going to somewhat call that in favor of women's health outcomes.
Agreed. I do agree.
There's two bits of research I wasn't able to work out how to bring in when we were doing this recording. The first bit is about the quality of care. So this was some social research done in the hospital context, and it compared the health outcomes for male and female patients from male healthcare professionals and then from female healthcare professionals to see if they could find that systemic bias. What it found out was that all possible outcomes, so male patients with male or female carers, female patients with male and female carers, four possible outcomes, it found that they were all basically identical or statistically insignificant in terms of their difference, but there was ever so slight a difference from female practitioners to female clients, which is that they had about a 1% better outcome. So even that is a very, very small number, so not much to work with. The articles I read about this research were reported as possibly indicating that male practitioners aren't as good or, you know, have a failing when it comes to understanding and relating to the needs of women, which is sort of the line that Inga was referring to with regards to female pain. I gender flipped this just as an exercise and imagined that it was the other way around, showing that male clients have better outcomes if they have male practitioners. And if that was the case, I would take that as evidence or a suggestion rather, and again, only a small one, but I would take that as a suggestion that women's needs are disregarded by the system and that the system itself fails and the men within it favour other men. But since it's not that way around, it's actually the other, I have to admit that the opposite might also be true, which is to say that female practitioners give female clients preferential treatment. I have to admit that possibility, but it is really not a big difference. So I'm a long way from landing on that. And, you know, this is just like one bit of research and so forth. However, it does to me sound like confirmation that outcomes are about the same for male and female clients. Which then just leaves the question regarding barriers to access and why men are less likely to take advantage of the healthcare that's available to them. That's a whole other topic. But yeah, I wanted to mention that piece of research since it was relevant. And the second one is with regards to the differences between funding for male and specific things. So this research is absolutely full of holes. I want to be the first one to mention that. There's a million spots where this could go that need to be like further looked into. But in short, in Victoria, Australia, where I am based, male-specific cancers kill about the same number of people as female-specific cancers. However, female-specific cancers receive generally, it looks like 5 times the funding, but possibly much more than that. So again, there's a lot of caveats and a lot of huge holes in this, such as the fact that there are just so many more female-specific cancers, and that could skew this data quite a bit. But it certainly argues, regardless, and even with a whole bunch of holes in it, it would seem to argue against the idea that we've got a system that is heavily in favour of men. It sort of looks like the opposite might be true, just from the perspective of funding for research and treatments and so forth.
Cool. So just as a running total, we've got men are ahead on one, women are ahead on two issues, and we've got one that's in that mixed, let's look into it in the future category. Point number five, housing conditions. My guess on that is that historically housing has gone along with wealth. So as we mentioned before, along with I'm curious as to what's happening there in keeping with the wealth transfer that we just mentioned and the increased wealth of women. So yeah, as of I think this year, this question becomes a bit more confusing, and I have not been able to find any great sources of data or ways of looking at the question of who has better quality housing overall. The only bit that I've been able to find anything that I can lean on is with regards to homelessness, which I think is generally what housing condition stuff refers to, but it's a broader issue. There's a difference between a high-quality flat and a shitty flat, which I don't know how to measure, and I suspect it might be women that are in the shittier flat. But with regards to homelessness, it's much clearer. There's twice as many male homeless people as female homeless people. And also within the category of – within the realm of homelessness, you've got a variety of conditions, starting with short-term but insecure housing – through to stuff like boarding houses and overnight or very, very limited accommodation, through to sleeping rough, so on the streets or in your car. And as you go through those categories, you've got more and more men up the sleeping rough end of the scale than the other. And, I mean, these issues are so complicated because you could say, well, yeah, that's because women are at more danger on the street. And whether that's perceived or accurate doesn't matter too much. Suffice to say, that's a horrible situation to be in. So I don't know. I'm going to call this one mixed. It's not super clear, but
on the indicators you've got, it's pretty clear.
Yeah, I just don't feel like they're really massively comprehensive. I mean, I kind of agree. It's like it looks like it's a little in favour of women, maybe.
Things that could be influencing some of that is that sometimes, quite often, women have networks that they can utilize to stay off the streets.
Ah, right. Community connectivity.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like that might be playing a part here.
Also, because women are oftentimes, what's the word I'm looking for, lumped with the kids. Our community does provide more in the way of services for people with kids, but that's really complicated. You can't really count that as a win for women. It sort of is.
I mean, if you're looking purely at this measure alone, standalone, then it does mean that as a community we look after that demographic more than we look after the other demographic that we're looking at, which is men.
I agree.
Be interesting also to look though at home ownership, like whether the ABS has got stats on that. And my guess would be that a lot more men own houses than women, but I don't, I might be entirely imagining that. I don't know.
My guess would be that too.
Just dropping in to say, with the benefit of more research time, this topic is really mixed. You can find some sources of information that support that homelessness tends to be consistently worse for male-type people, but the more broad topic of home ownership, you can find data to suggest that women have got it better, you can find data to suggest that men have got it better. It's really mixed, so having thrown a lot of time at it, I'm just going to leave that one there as mixed for the moment.
You've got homework, Rog.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's something I'm going to look up.
Let's just call it mixed. Okay, next category, access to services and resources. So this doesn't refer to things that we're referring to elsewhere, like employment or things like political access and representation and stuff. So this is more just about community services and resources relating to quality of life, which we've sort of been touching on and hinting at already. It's another one where it's hard to get really good, solid, overarching data on it. But one source that I have found interesting is up until not so long back, the Victorian government used to produce a comprehensive community services guide, which I believe was a list of basically every service that receives government funding. So it's pretty thorough, and that's any level of government funding. I went through and I counted, and for every one male-specific service, there was way more than 20 female-specific services. And between those extremes, there's services in the middle that at least in theory, serve everyone. But I suspect there's also probably a female bias there. And I've also seen other data suggesting that women are much more likely to be engaged in services for the same reasons we mentioned around homelessness, because things are often family-related. So that is much more likely to put you in connection with support services, community resources, and so forth, even though that entire world is grossly under-resourced. So in terms of access to services and resources, I'm leaning towards women being somewhat or well ahead in that category. So if we're in agreement so far, and again, listener, don't worry if you're not with me on all of the details, but so far we've got one for men, three for women, and two kind of mixed. Next area, oh, this is a fun one. Next area is discrimination and social exclusion. Isn't that fun, kids?
Ah, sure.
So in terms of discrimination with regards to, say, employment, good research has been done and it's been well reported on around the bias that exists when women are applying for classically male jobs. And that has been, I think, accurately reported as evidence of discrimination against women, particularly in employment. The fun thing is you can replicate exactly the same results in reverse if you get male-sounding names applying for traditionally female jobs. You know, your teaching, your nursing, etc., human care roles, you get exactly the same bias in reverse. So that one seems to go both ways. And yet, in general, men are more likely to have a positive bias towards stuff to do with work, workplace, etc. Women are more likely to have a positive bias with regards to family and community roles. So that one's that little sub-element's mixed, but another really fun one is, have you two heard about or are familiar with inherent bias?
Vaguely?
It's a stream of sociology, it's a stream of social science that sort of started up in particular around the 80s or got popular around the 80s, and it aims to, a lot of people are familiar with like ink blot tests where you show someone a quick sample and you get them just to grab a word out of their head. So it's a similar kind of philosophy where, like, the original research used a rapid fire process of information to get people's associations. And the thing about the rapid fire side of it is that it gets stuff out of your brain before you've had a chance to filter it. And you can also measure literally the amount of time it takes to make an association as evidence of how much a person is having to work to make it look like they're a nice person. So the long and the short of that, and the really important thing about it, is that polite folks like us that probably are genuinely not racist, I think I can probably speak for the three of us, we are nevertheless in this world, and we've just been presented with so many images that portray people of colour negatively, that we, I'll speak in the first person, I still have race-based biases that are negative and racist. So that's kind of where the core of the work began. From there, that sprung out into a whole bunch of other different ways to measure the same stuff, and the results over time have become quite consistent. And so, of course, you're wondering what happens when you look at gender through that lens.
Oh, no, I think I know. But well, regale me with facts, will you?
Well, it's really funny. Okay, I will. It's really funny because the people that are motivated to do this research in the first place are well-intentioned, left-leaning people who would also relate to a statement like, this is a man's world and the patriarchy looks after men. So they were assuming that they were going to be finding a general loathing and distaste for women and a bias towards men. What they found, and the reason why you haven't heard it reported, is because we love women. And we love women in every role. What has been reported is stuff like, we trust women less, work and business arrangements.
Sorry about the audio. That's meant to say we trust women slightly less in relation to business and work arrangements than we do in other areas, but still much more so than we do men.
That's because we prefer them just a little less than we prefer them in all the other areas, which is basically about 70% preference for women, 30% preference for men. Like, it's a really extreme split. And in the case of workplace stuff, it's like 60 or 65 instead of 70% positive bias. And the bias from women towards women is stronger, but even the bias from men towards women is stronger. And if the lovely listener would like to do their own research, this finding, this dynamic, was framed, women are wonderful, or WAW, W-A-W for short. So if you want to do some research on that and like check those numbers. The reason that's interesting, in the same way that that research was originally put together to help us see how discrimination and social exclusion happens towards people of colour, I suggest that the same follows for male-presenting folks. There's also the loneliness epidemic, which is that women have got way more friends, both in terms of quality and quantity, and that the loneliness epidemic has huge implications for mental and physical health. It's worse than smoking.
You're talking unconscious biases here, basically, aren't you?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, unconscious biases feed into the discrimination and social exclusion. Yeah.
Yeah.
And just a funny little side journey also is I'd suggest that if we're talking about exclusion, I'd also suggest that the gender debate itself, the gender equality debate itself, is one of the most important debates of our time. And generally speaking, men are excluded from, or men's issues at least, are excluded from that debate. So in terms of discrimination and social exclusion, you can see where I'm landing. I'm landing strongly in favour of women for that one.
And in terms of unconscious bias, it would appear that the ABS has shown for the last 20 years or more that women have owned more houses than men. And yet all three of us thought it was going to be the other way around.
Oh,
well, interesting, isn't it?
Though if you think about what you said about wealth, that is one of the key things that would be feeding into their wealth is house ownership, particularly when a partner, et cetera, dies. So, yeah, that would be how that flows.
Yeah, and maybe some of those women are just like fancy tax traps. But nevertheless, that's amazing.
Yep.
Thank you for that research.
Yeah, so good and interesting research can be.
Yep.
And how much our little hidden biases are all lurking around, even though all three of us are really keen to dissect these issues.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something that it just snuck up on all of us.
I think not just our biases, but also the biases of the media and the information we're exposed to and the stuff that our community talks about. And we're doing a whole section coming up on the media cycle and research and what gets published and what gets read. okay. The eighth point is criminal justice involvement. I mean, I think this is a no-brainer, but a spot where you can find like discrimination and overrepresentation, or this is actually more a point of discrimination actually, is around sentencing and conviction rates for similar crimes. And you know, you can do some filtering around that, but when we look at race from this perspective, there's no question that people of colour are about 10% overrepresented in conviction and sentencing times and rates. They're both kind of similar. Would you care to take a stab at how overrepresented men are for like crimes?
Oh, triple?
It'd be ridiculous, wouldn't it? Same as the workplace kind of rates, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's 50%. Like So people of colour are overrepresented by 10%. Men are overrepresented by 50%. And not overrepresented, like their likelihood of being convicted and the length of their sentence. So phenomenal. Like we're used to the idea of racism, and the level of, criminal justice overrepresentation and involvement is phenomenal there. And there's just simply like we know that our jails are about 97% male, and there's just no version of events where the privileged part of the community makes up that number of jail patronage. I can't find the right word. and some of that can be explained by, you could go down a path of saying a fair bit of that is explained by male physical violence, which we know is massively more of a thing. But you can't explain away all of that, all of those statistics. So for point number eight, criminal justice involvement, obviously that one lands in favour of women. And the last point, political participation and representation. I'm not going to go into any detail. I'm just going to say men win. So in summary, like to add that tally up, men win in two of those categories. Women win in five of those categories. And two of them are like mixed or undecided, or one of them was slightly in favour of women, but yeah. And so are we good to go on to my supplementary list?
Yeah.
So the five, my five supplementaries were levels of violence, giving and receiving. So yeah, that one is men lose on that front. That actually probably deserves a little bit of explaining. A lot of people think that women suffer more violence than men. Men suffer about twice in almost every category, even when you include partner violence, which is incredibly tilted the other way. Like physical partner violence is almost entirely from men towards women. But even when you include that, men receive overall approximately twice the amount of violence. Next point is likelihood of dying in a violent or a bloody way. So again, men are about twice as likely as women to be murdered. Just as a fun thought experiment, it's fun to imagine what it would be like if we had conscription for women, like if we sent our women to war. Imagine, I think most of us would clock that as an act of gendered violence and an outrage. Almost every country that has conscription is conscription for men. There's very few examples of conscription for women. And likewise, when we talk about deaths, either from like say acts of terrorism or acts of God or whatever, generally speaking, we'll say blah, blah number were killed, including women and children, or including X number of women and children. So we articulate the ones we care about. I've got a little side story on that one. At the moment, as we record, there's a few wars going on around the world, but there's two that are prominent in Western media. One is the Israel-Gaza war, and the other one is the Russia-Ukraine war. the Israel-Gaza war has received some attention because there's been slightly more female deaths than male deaths. When you count civilian and military deaths, there's women are slightly overrepresented. And that's received a lot of attention. It's been described as a war on women. In contrast, in Russia and Ukraine, as of when I researched this, which was about July of 2024, on the Russian side, out of 27,000 deaths in total, 4 of them were female. And on the Ukraine side, out of 70...
Four women. Okay, cool.
Four women out of 27,000.
Excellent. Cool.
So bit of a tilt there.
Yes.
And on the Ukrainian side, out of a total of 70,000 deaths, 100 women. So if you add that together, you've got a ratio which is extremely close to 1,000 women to 100,000 men.
Mm.
What I want to know is why is no one reporting that as a war on men?
Yes, they don't.
Yeah, and the implication there is that, well, because men deserve it, and, you know, men start war, so it's men that finish war, and it's not really an actual problem. But, yeah, we're there's an invisibility around how to what extent men die in a violent or bloody way. So much so that that does explain some of the length of life gap. It explains like a percent or thereabouts.
It absolutely would, and particularly over, in Ukraine.
Yes, it would.
That's generational.
Yes. Yes, that's a point on likelihood of dying in a violent or bloody way. My next supplementary point is around the suicide rate. Men suicide at about 3 or 4 times the rate that women do, and both or all genders attempt suicide at a higher rate than that. But in terms of, I'm into tricky language here, and it sounds like I'm taking the piss, and I really don't want to. So I'll just back out of that corner and just say yes, men commit suicide much more often, and also the peak time for suicide is 9 a.m. on a Monday morning, or at least it used to be last time I checked, which sort of suggests that the privilege of work is not quite such a privilege.
can attest to that, yes.
My fourth supplementary point is access to family and community. And my fifth supplementary point is around happiness. Happiness surveys are another area of social research which has become quite scientific. You can sort of rig them. If you come into it from a perspective of, well, this is what I think makes people happy, therefore we just measure who's got more of that and who doesn't. You can make a happiness survey come out any way you want, but the science is much more rigorous around that. And there's been studies going on now that are not just a couple of generations, but multiple generations long now, and that don't just work to assumptions of what we think would make a person happy, but really thoroughly interrogating the people around you, and health, suicide, et cetera, et cetera. Women are much happier, although interestingly getting a little bit less so over time. And again, I would hint that the workplace is not quite the bundle of joy that women were told that it was. As women get access to more and more of the male world, it's not quite as joyous as we thought it would be.
That's all that much greener.
No, it's not.
What we do know about happiness is there's a couple of trends emerging. It's very influenced by your friendship circles and your sense of community. Women are stronger in those areas. The sense that you're doing something useful in the world, and for a lot of people, family itself is a tick in that box. But we also find women gravitating towards jobs that are more likely to have a connection with a sense of doing something nice for people, like nursing and teaching, although I note that teaching can be very complicated. And there's also around like what contributes to happiness is the way the world looks at you, the way you are perceived by the world. So I walk around the street and I just am seen as a threat and a danger by literally everyone I see. And it's funny, that's a nuanced and a different experience to being seen as flesh by the entire world. But I guess, like, you know, obviously neither of those are great, but I would say, like, harking back to the implicit bias research.
Like, if I use an example that happens to me quite often when yep. I'm out and around, I am non-threatening. I am of a size where that flesh aspect doesn't come into things as much, but I am also non-threatening. I get asked for directions quite often when I'm out and about.
Right.
Always.
Right. I get avoided.
I wish I was avoided.
I get you. Neither side of this exchange is a win.
No, not really. But yeah, it's interesting to be read as somebody who's going to be helpful.
Yeah. And I guess, like, more generally, like, we're going to be doing some stuff on gender separate spaces, but just putting me in a space makes it unsafe. And that does not make me happy. So if we're talking about happiness.
Yeah, absolutely.
So out of my supplementaries, that's 5 out of 5 for women. So you can see where I'm going with all of this. Out of what seem to be pretty standard measures of advantage and disadvantage, looking at it through developed Western world kind of perspective, women are miles ahead. At the same time, we know that men are privileged. So that brings us to the great gender privilege paradox. Or said differently, what the fuck? What the fuck?
It's degrees. A lot of these things are degrees. And, you know, we talked about race, and if you talk about intersectionality, and we talk about age, and we talk about location in the world, then some of these things get differently skewed. Yeah. I don't think it undermines that the fact that a person is a man definitely holds some privilege, but it's not the whole, as you say, it's not the whole story, right?
Right.
So
right.
Women can navigate some aspects of the world easier because there was such a gap for so long, the services and focus is all skewed. So right. There's a real focus on, I mean, you could see this as a measure of success in some ways, in that we now have more equity, except that we probably skewed the other way. Might need to also bring a focus on the other genders and other minority groups in general,
yep.
So that doesn't play as much of a factor.
Yeah. I think the thing I find fascinating about the paradox is that, like, the standard model of just saying, like, men are privileged, full stop, that's all there is to it. It just can't explain all of what we've just gone through with those measures. And as I say, like, we can disagree on or agree on various bits of the detail, but it's not a straightforward, easy picture. It's definitely not 100% in favour of men, 0% in favour of women. And that's generally the way we talk about it when we're talking about privilege and we're using the standard model to look at that. So what I suggest by way of solution is essentially just opening up that word privilege and looking into it in much more detail. I propose a much higher resolution look. So first, like, definitions. A privilege is something that gives you priority access to something you want. So that raises the question of, like, what is it that you want? And I might even, when I'm doing the editing, just cut in some silence here to reflect. But I know that, like, I've run workshops on stuff like this and asked this question. And what people tend to say is a mix of stuff. But the themes that come up most is stuff like friends, or purpose, or health, or family, or career. Happiness comes up a great deal. A lot of people answer happiness. That is overrepresented in people's answers. People want enjoyable work. People want safety. I think they're the main sorts of things that people speak about, like, what they want in life. And from there, I would like, so going back, so a privilege is something that gives you access, perhaps unfair access, to something that you want. And what we want in life is actually like pretty diverse there. So I'd like to break the concept of privilege down into four categories rather than just looking at it as one amorphous blob that you either have or don't have. I'd like to break it down in four categories, which also have a whole bunch of subcategories within them. So I'll just quickly fly through them and then we'll expand on them a little bit. So the four categories are physical privileges. Second category is societal and structural privileges. Third category is psychological privileges. And the fourth category is this weird, slightly amorphous one. Don't get too caught up on it. Spiritual privilege, but it doesn't necessarily mean religious. And weirdly, it can also be scientific. So to go through them in a little more detail, physical privileges are, and like, feel free to help me out and brainstorm this with me, gang. Your health would be a physical privilege. Your hand-eye coordination would be a physical privilege. Whether you happen to have a body type that is seen by the world as sexually desirable.
Mm. Age would come into that as well, which is a bit of a funny one because it's a moving target.
Yes. Yes. Some of these things, this might be getting too abstract, but age is actually a function of your demographic, the group that you belong to. And the group that you belong to will define which privileges you have better access to. So, for instance, if one of the things you want is health, then if your age is younger, that's going to give you better access to that. But if one of the things you want is happiness, then older age is going to give you better access to that. So, yeah. So, likewise, you know, obviously from this perspective, when we're looking at this detail, you can't say that, say, like male or female in themselves are privileges. They will give you access to some of these other privileges or not, but they're more a function of your demographic. So like I would say that I'm, you know, let's say male, middle-aged, middle-class, white-skinned. So that's all stuff around my demographic identity, and that's going to give me access to various of these privileges. So circling back on physical privileges, whether you are able-bodied, like whether you can walk or whether you need assistance for that.
Being tall and broad would be a far more mostly useful privilege as a teacher. A male, taller, broader shouldered, louder voiced, often, not always, obviously, because I've got a pretty loud voice. But those things can regularly be advantageous.
And Emma, you bring teaching experience to the table, so you know this territory.
Yes.
Yeah.
And a little, you know, I mean, I'm not a little meek female, so I don't have to worry about it too much, but I'm definitely short. And just the automatic, well, there's so many layers of privilege that I don't get being a female teacher walking into a lot of the schools I walk into.
Yeah, right.
I just don't have what, like, I watch the male or even the male CRTs doing a similar job to me. Just the kids are just quieter straight off and things like that. Like, and who knows how many different angles of privilege is or isn't kicking in, right? And, you know, the moment of a teacher walking into a room.
It's
fascinating to see the differences.
And who knows how much of it's like respect or fear. But yeah,
knowledge, anything could be.
I hear you.
Thousands of things.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry about that. That's really fuck.
Thank you. Yeah, but height in that sense, being able to be taller than people around you can often be an advantage. Sometimes it's not. Like if you're about to be sniped, that would not be an advantage. And in a plane, being too tall and so on is not fun, whereas I can pack into small spaces. So there's funny little levels of privilege that we often wouldn't think about in terms of our physicality.
Yeah.
So we can pack you in a suitcase.
Yes.
But you're not good for a towering presence over people.
I think I mentioned health. You could argue that immunity, I mean, that's just a part of health. So there, Things like that are all of your physical privileges. Your societal or structural privileges. I feel like this is the sort of area where you might have just been touching on a little bit, Emma. Like if people are expecting to see a particular gender in a particular role, then it's easier for that gender to be in that role. And so maybe there's more authority and assumed righteousness that comes with men, male presenting teachers, particularly in that secondary environment that you're in, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Conversely, a woman in a therapy type role.
Yes.
That, you know, that being read as nurtured and caring.
Yes.
When somebody needs to talk and impart, you know, how they're feeling, can be seen as definite advantage.
Yes.
Sometimes too.
As someone that's been in the world of psychology for 25 years, and I've also maintained lists and stuff many times, I've heard people say that they just refuse to see male counsellors. Mm. But if we're looking at organisational structures and management charts, if we're looking at political representation, if we're looking at leadership roles, yeah, all of those sorts of things, obviously, most of these things are heavily biased towards demographics that are male.
Society decision makers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then the next area is psychological privileges. So this relates to sort of how well you know yourself and also how well you know the people around you, or how well you can work them, how well you can play them. So knowledge of self, like knowing how you're going to respond in a given situation, being like somewhat relatively at peace with your mental health, being able to be emotionally fluid, being able to articulate and find words for your emotions, being able to communicate generally, being able to read people, understand what's probably going on for people, even when they're masking or running a story or whatever, being able to resolve conflicts, being able to collaborate, being able to talk people down, being able to hold down relationships. These are all psychological privileges.
Mm. That's a mixed bag.
Yes.
Just thinking about different genders in those spaces, that's quite a mixed bag.
I feel like most of that category is stuff that we socialise women folk with, and women folk often bemoan the fact that they do a lot of the unpaid emotional labour in that whole area and complain that men have got poor relationship and communication skills. And I'm paraphrasing the language is often more passionate.
100%. While also acknowledging that in the hierarchies of executive land, you have more men folk doing more intimidation and influencing, and of other men folk and women folk as well. So that reading people and getting what you want from someone, not always necessarily done in the healthiest ways, but they're still very effective.
Yeah.
So there is some of that. And again, I would say that what we just did there with the psychological stuff is go touchy-feely feelings, not what is the impact on how are other ways that that can be used and works as well, not just from a feelings perspective, but from an actually navigating the world perspective.
Yeah. Yep. Love it. And the last category there, it's a slightly amorphous one. Let's not get caught up on it too much. And in some ways it's just an extension of psychological rank, but it's been presented or taught to me as spiritual rank or spiritual privilege. So that's a level of detachment from the world that you sometimes see in people that are of a profound spiritual way, where you're just at peace with the world and everything that happens. You almost, an example that's sometimes given is, like I have no idea whether this is true or not, but Taoist or Zen Buddhists have proven hard to torture, because you can look at someone inflicting pain on you and feel sorry for them, or you feel compassion and love for them, and you can look at your own experience of pain and just go, wow, isn't that amazing? And if you're able to have that level of spiritual detachment from the world, then you've won. So yeah, you're gonna have much more.
Won?
Well, you've won the happiness game or something, or you've won I mean, bearing in mind, most of the time we're not being tortured. Most of the time we're just going through regular life.
But are you sure? I think it's the same, but.
And I think a really funny thing about the idea of spiritual privilege is the scientific community often has the same sense of comfort in terms of like knowing where you come from, knowing how a nervous system works, being able to look at the funny complex interaction of human beings through a detached lens. Anyway, I think the three most important ones are the physical privileges, the societal and structural privileges, and the psychological ones. And these category ideas, they're useful, but they're not absolute. So there are some things that fit across multiple categories. If you take something like, if one of the things you want in life is sex or sexuality, then that your how you physically present is going to help you to get started in that realm. But how you follow through psychologically is going to be a really important factor as well. So, you know, stuff fits in all over the place. And yeah, it's also worth stating that basically all privileges are double-edged swords. So I gave the example before that women will sometimes complain that they feel like they're doing all of the unpaid emotional labor work on behalf of menfolk. But at the same time, just being able to like having the skills to do that work in the first place is a privilege. It's much better to be able to navigate those things yourself rather than rely on someone else to navigate them for you. Likewise, having an easier road to managerial and high income jobs is obviously a privilege. But then again, working yourself nearly to death and losing connection with friends and family is not a privilege. Being attractive means that you're likely to get paid significantly more and you will have access to at least the start part of relationships. But sometimes people will want to take your attractiveness off you without your consent. So all privileges, I think, maybe that's too big of a statement. Let's just go with most privileges have got an element of double-edgedness to them. And I'm not saying that those things even out or negate each other or that they're even. Just saying that, yeah, all things are complicated. And we often oversimplify.
Sorry.
Them. Yeah, no, you go.
To quote Comic Land, with great power comes great responsibility.
Ah, love it. So to circle back around to the start when we started expanding privilege, I asked the question of, like, what do you want in life? So what you want in life determines which of these privileges are important to you. And I think one of the things that I don't like about the standard model is that we assume that those societal and structural privileges are the only ones that mean anything. And they are not. If you look at the complexity of what people actually want in life, it's a real spread across those three categories. Like, for instance, obviously, if you want money, then societal and structural privileges, including being born into money and being of the gender in the context of this conversation that is more associated with money, is very advantageous. Likewise, political voice. If you want to enjoy sport, as per that example before, then physical privileges are very important. If you want friends and family, then psychological privileges are very important. And if you want happiness, then like once you get past some financial baselines, basically out of poverty, according to the country you're in, then most of what you want for happiness is psychological privileges and maybe those spiritual ones if you want to take it to the extreme. For me, this model explains everything. Like, when we looked through that measure of those measures of advantage and disadvantage, we came up with such a confusing mess of stuff. This layer of looking at privilege can include all of that stuff that we were discussing and all of those points of confusion. It makes sense within this higher resolution look at privilege. like just to pick a couple, the male suicide rate, that cannot be explained by the simple model that says men are privileged. That you just can't have both of those things. But this model that I've just described does, because it shows us that work itself is not necessarily the most fun thing in the world, and really the things that keep us happy are more likely to be the psychology stuff. And if you don't have the school, the capacity to recognize that you need help and to ask for help and to have help resources available, which are all psychological privileges, then suicide is more likely. Another one is why women feel stared at or taken advantage of on a street environment, but at the same time can charge good money just to be looked at. The basic model that just says men are privileged doesn't explain that, but the more complex model that says, wow, it's complicated, does. How are we going? Thoughts or questions?
I'm with you. No, okay. I'm with you.
I think a really fun thing about this is that the more complex model also, ironically, explains gender politics and the gender equality movement. In that, women have got more psychological privilege, gross generalization, massive apologies for the generalization, but something in the approximate zone of women have got more psychological privilege. And with psychological privilege comes the capacity to understand and articulate your problems, especially if you haven't had your vulnerability socialized out of you, like in general men have. So women have therefore defined privilege, like most of this work comes from the women's movement and the race movement. Women have understandably defined privilege in ways that make sense to them. And focused on the privileges they don't have. So like I said at the start, we're much better at spotting the privileges that we don't have. So women collectively have focused on those societal and structural privileges, just to be clear, for great reasons, and thank God we're making some progress. What hasn't been focused on so much is those psychological privileges, and bearing in mind we also spoke about the pain of realizing that something you're good at is partly because you've worked very hard at it and partly because you've been given it. That's a very unattractive thing to stare down.
You quite often develop the tools you need because you have to.
That's also
true. Keep yourself afloat.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's true of all of the things, though, because a lot of men folk would say, "Well, I have to go out and do that to my body in the workplace." Because
100%. I absolutely agree.
But I totally agree with you. As women folk, that's what you have to do to like get a family, get relationships, blah, blah, blah.
Some of my best recognizing what is going on in people is because of trauma. Mm. Mm. It makes me very good at a lot of my jobs. However, it comes from trauma.
Yeah, right.
I would prefer not to know what was going on for people just by reading their body language. I'd be blissfully unaware. That wasn't a choice I had.
And without knowing nor asking what you're referring to, we know that people who have experienced various forms of trauma or abuse in the past tend to be what you'd regard as hypervigilant. And they're also extremely good at spotting when a situation is escalating.
Those things. I would agree. As I said, it makes me extraordinarily good at my jobs. However,
good for you. I hope it's okay for us to be joking about. You're smiling. You started.
100% fine. Okay. If I don't laugh about my trauma, I'd have to cry and fuck that. In this instance, I'd rather be a man where I wasn't allowed to cry because that would actually fit with how I feel about that. However, I would prefer that people were allowed to cry and weren't made fun of because of that. It's just not my – it's I've also been made fun of that, so I understand. fun trauma.
So as a consequence of those really generalized biases where physical privileges are kind of mixed, complicated, societal and structural ones men have an advantage in, and psychological ones women have an advantage in. Because of that, we have this funny situation where men are everywhere. Like men are extremely visible, but men's issues are almost invisible. In contrast, women's issues are pretty familiar to most people most of the time, but women themselves are underrepresented in most public outward kind of spaces. And yeah, that this model of privilege explains exactly how that came to be.
And why there is such a focus on the visible rather than the invisible.
Right, right, right. Yes, yes.
In both, we focus on men's privilege because we can see it, not their problems because we don't see it.
Yeah.
We focus on how we're fixing things for women because we can see it, but not other way. Yeah.
Yes, and we also we focus on men because men are everywhere, and you know most of history is retold with men.
Yep.
What I also love about this, aside from the fact that I find that mathematically appealing, what I also love about it is that it leads us straight to the answers in a way that the basic model does not. So that like the basic model just says men are privileged, yet they're playing up. What are you going to do? There's nowhere to go with that. Whereas this model shows us exactly what needs to happen. So in the same way that when women worked out they were missing out on all of that societal and structural stuff, they lawyered up and started gaining access. And again, yay. This shows us that what we are all in desperate need of, not just men, we all need men to do this, but we need men to start getting access to female privileges. And I think it's important to use that word because it comes back to we have an inherent understanding that things need to be shared. And also that there is something incredibly valuable over there. In some ways, like it's a bit of an irony actually. Like when we talk about those male domains like they're the only important ones. And when we don't give credit to the psychological stuff, family, friends, community, culture, society, etc. We're actually buying into a patriarchal view of the world that only values men type stuff. How's the irony?
Pretty funny. We would need to revalue the psychological stuff to give it the same importance as some of this other, the societal and structural stuff.
And I think
to
we
then
should
make it be valuable enough that people want that.
Yes.
All people want that. While trying not to do that in a violent way. Because we do get changed by violence and we've seen that.
Yeah.
Probably not the answer if we're looking for psychological safety.
Probably not. And I think you're right. I think like if you make a little list of all of the quote problem with men unquote, basically all of them get better or possibly disappear if we could get men more access to that cluster of skills or privileges. In the same way that so many problems that women have faced historically, like for instance, economic equality, women needed to get access to the privileges that men have. It's just, same in reverse.
It's a lot of pendulum swinging.
Yeah. I think we need to do both at once rather than just focusing on one side, focusing our side, whatever. And I know that talking about it this way, there's something that intuitively feels like this runs the risk of distracting from the important issues. Like sometimes you'll actually hear that when you bring up stuff like, oh, men are missing out in these areas, you'll often get the response along the lines of, right, okay, well, we'll get to them once we've solved the real problems. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense that we can't allow the attention to go to those areas because it's going to distract and it's going to put women in danger. I get that intuitively it can feel that way. I just don't think it's the case because I think that focusing on what men are missing out on is going to make men better and it's going to make, in turn, the experience of women so much better.
Why I worded it the way I did before is it's about increasing the value of the psychological stuff, for want of a better way to say that, that benefits women because it increases their status in society. It benefits men because it gives them access to that because it's suddenly more valuable to have. And it also benefits a whole bunch of other minorities outside of those two binaries because it also makes it accessible to them as well.
Nice.
And support that they want. That's why I said it the way I said it, is because it's about increasing the value of that particular bunch of things that are supportive for everyone, actually. It's not just for men. So
nice. I love it. And that for me is why I promised at the start that, I didn't promise, but I was hoping that we'd get to a spot of hope. And for me, like what you've just said, what we're talking about here, for me, this is hopeful because there is actually a really obvious solution here that we can follow. And I think if you imagine that you are a man folk type of a person, and imagine I'm going to give you two messages. One message says you're privileged, you have everything, yet you behave badly, we don't trust you, and we're punishing you. So that's like one message. The other message is, hey, you've missed out on something really important that's going to make your life much better, and we would like to share it with you. Which of those messages is going to get you interested in looking at privilege, soft skills?
So I pick the first one.
I grew up with the first one. So, I'm like, what's wrong with that? I'm like, oh, wait, hang on. The second one, I think. So that actually, seriously, that actually does highlight a problem, though. So if I've been told I'm wrong in, you know, I have everything,
yeah,
and I'm also wrong in how I show up in the world,
yeah,
and suddenly you want to talk about my feelings, I might say go get fucked.
Yeah, it's a generational change that needs to happen.
As you said before, it's a slap in the face because what it highlights is all of the ways I've been treated wrong in the world.
Yeah. So yeah.
What we see online with people who are speaking about men's rights.
Yeah.
And I use those terms.
Yeah.
Is that there is a significant backlash and we get some very angry people, particularly men folk, who don't have alternative messages to say, actually, we're listening to you in a healthy way. So,
oh my God, yeah.
Yeah. So that's tricky. It's like when you first start any therapy of any description and you suddenly realize how bad things have been because somebody is looking at you going, oh my God, I'm so sorry that happened to you. And you're like, what? That's like Tuesday. Like, I don't understand. But having to process that is tricky. So how do we not only provide those services, but give space in our lives to people who are going through that at various ages for the first time and have a whole backlog of things that are really tricky to deal with, and still show up and go to work and, you know, have family and show up for your friends and not go stir crazy in the meantime. So yeah. I have hope, but also it's hard.
You raise such an important point. Yes, I think everything you're saying is absolutely right. I think that this shift, if we're to go down this path, like it is going to take the absolute quickest you can possibly imagine it happening, is still multiple generations long. And at the moment, unfortunately, I see that if we're talking about pendulum swings, I actually think we're still swinging into worse territory at the moment. So at the moment, things are getting worse, in my opinion. You speak about such an important thing. So I have, for me personally, gender separate groups or gender specific groups are not the right space for me because I think we need to be working on stuff together. So except for a period in my early 20s when I started leaning into this stuff and starting to explore it, and I was participating in and running men's groups, I've got some visibility over watching this dynamic play out there. And also because this is not the first time I've spoken to this subject material, although this is by far the most comprehensive, but I have spoken about it before, and I have been approached by people that have been socialized male about what goes on for them as they have the experience that you're talking about. And it is wild. So It's quite funny. We say to men, go off and discover your inner feminine. And so they go away and they have a look into stuff. Ironically, one of the things that is part of the feminine archetype at the moment is understanding how you've been fucked over by this world and then articulating it. So this really funny thing happens to men that are going through that process. They want to speak up about it. And generally what happens is we tell them to shut the fuck up and sit down again. We'll get to your problems once we've dealt with the real ones. And it puts them in an incredible state. Sometimes it leads to incels and the violent, nasty parts of the men's rights movement that you're referring to. Like they're winding up in the lap of pickup artists and Andrew Tate. It is not working out well. No. And I don't mean to over-dramatize when I say sometimes they suicide at this point in time. And I have been contacted by multiple men type people who have said, thank you for what you've said about privilege. It stopped me from suiciding.
Yeah, I know people who've had the experiences that you're talking about. And I've dated some men type folk who've wandered into the more incel type paths. And I've dated people and been around people, men folk who've realized just how badly they've been treated previously and that they don't have to do that anymore. But by golly, that's a rough journey.
Yeah. And when you pluck up the courage and you go over your edge to be emotionally vulnerable, maybe I should speak in the first term, mm-hmm. first person. When I've plucked up the courage to be vulnerable and say, yes, I've been hurt in these ways, and when the response I get from the world is not just to be like, denied or ignored and gaslit, but actually like isolated for being so stupid to think that there could be such a thing as male problems. It is such a bewildering spot to be in, and I can see the temptation to rush off to the angry men's movement and have the pendulum swing back the other way and surround myself with one-sided people from the other side of the fence. And I've battled that temptation the entire time because, as my mate Gandhi was always saying, intervene in the way of the solution, yo. Don't just go repeating the same shit over and over again. I'm paraphrasing. But, I can see the attraction. And when we do that, it's just pendulum swinging backwards and forwards. And, yep. You know, the women's movement is reacting to a patriarchal society, and the women's pendulum swing hasn't even completed its arc yet. It's never going to. Mm-hmm. And already the other side is building up.
I'm not a fan of extremists.
No.
For reasons. But the outcome is never good.
Yeah, no.
Like, I like the how do we do this together aspect. That I think needs to happen.
I think it has to be together. And being one-sided about it and only having an interest in whether it's your gender or the other gender, if we're looking at a two-gender state solution, to things, I do not think that that's the solution. So I think in the current landscape, one of the most radical acts of gender activism that you can do is to get an interest in men's issues as well as women's and other gender issues.
Certainly the young teenagers that I'm working with a lot, I was talking to you separately and recently socially, Rog, about that, you know, they're all like, yeah, Andrew Tate, and they're all getting right onto it. And these are, you know, between 12 and 15-year-old boys who are all going, yeah, Andrew Tate. And I'm like, oh, God. And in this, you know, milliseconds of time that I had to go, oh, how am I going to engage with these kids? And was really able to genuinely say, it's really important that you guys feel heard and cared for. And they all just sort of stopped and went, Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I said, yeah. And I just really hope that you find something that shows love and compassion to do that for you and for other people in your life, because I think that's going to be a more sustainable way of getting that. And they all went, oh, and it, you know, lost a few of them, but that instant of being able to say you deserve to feel powerful and heard was exactly what they wanted, because they thought I was about to say, oh, no, but you don't, like, that's not valuable or that's not important or some other dissing version of you shouldn't expect to feel good, powerful, strong, heard, valid. You know, they were expecting to hear that. And so to be able to say, no, it really is super important that you are valid and validated. And they went, yeah, that's right. And then I said, and you know, should we all look at some sort of sustainable way of that happening? And they went, okay, but at least I didn't lose them, you know. Like,
yeah.
And I think the inclusion was the only thing that meant it wasn't just a verbal or, you know, ongoing war even between us, let alone you and the rest of their lives. So
we've got a whole whole episode or whole conversation coming up on gender separate spaces, but one of the drawbacks from them is that the very people who we most desperately need to hear about our issues are not present when we talk about them, if we only talk about them with our own gender present. And obviously there's an incredible usefulness in that, in comparing notes with folks just like us who have been through similar experiences. But at some stage, I suggest way earlier than most people think, we need to do that. And what you just said, Emma, is just like so beautiful when we can hear each other's experiences across the lines. I was in an intimate conversation with someone the other day. We were talking about gender issues, this person, AFAB, me, AMAB. And at a certain point in the conversation, it was just right for me to say, I am so sorry for what my people have done to you and your people. I am so sorry. And they cried and I cried. And then they said, and I am so sorry for what my people have done to you and your people.
Yeah.
And we cried. And it was just so beautiful and stunning to do it across the gender lines.
And I was also thinking, listening before when we were talking about, you know, the shock of hearing that our privilege is also our how to say this. So it can often be pretty alarming to hear that the things that I might personally have gone, oh, this is hard for me, is actually a privilege, or, oh, this is my privilege is actually causing me difficulties or whatever, you know, like finding out that level of self-awareness that needs to come of going, oh, the things that I take for granted that I use every day, like, oh, I can batter my eyelids and get away with 20 things more than a male in the same situation could get away with. Or, you know, and do I use that? Don't I use that? Where's my level of self-awareness? How far is that going to repercuss? You know, there's just so many layers of it all. And to sort of sit there and go, well, the whole conversations in my ideal world will be done a lot more caringly of the fact that we're all blind to our own privilege and all suck it into our own privilege. Like we're all using it to various reasons and various means being met, and to sort of go, oh, well, what you're doing is wrong. It's not really going to help anything.
Oh, and this is why I love looking into the concept of privilege, and why I said I'm sad that it's become politicized and become a like an angry whack over the head thing, because there's so much richness and self-development in it, self-awareness.
It's weaponized. It's been weaponized, yeah.
Yeah.
Noting that, you know, some of these spaces have been polarized in those gender kind of separate ways. What I have seen in a more corporate land is an acknowledgement that gender, what used to be, you know, women, you know, celebrate women kind of employer resource group, is now a gender equity employer resource group. So there's an acknowledgement that, you know, women helping women is fine, but it only gets you so far. We actually need a broader conversation, a more inclusive conversation. And so instead of making things available to women, though that sometimes does absolutely happen, it's also like, are our parental leave policies and equal across genders? How do we broaden those things? So I see at one end it's being way polarized, and I can also see that switch into, oh, we can't do this by ourselves. We need to be together in this. That needs to go further.
We all need each other's help and to have each other's backs. And I love what you say about parental leave, and you know, I'm dot, dot, dot hinting towards an upcoming episode, but like that right there is the solution to the pay gap.
Yeah, totally.
But we'll expand on that another time.
Cool.
Cool.
Well, it appears we like the topic.
That was a juicy topic.
Okay, here are some afterthoughts on the privilege episode. First afterthought, a reflection I've got as I listen back in the editing process is that there's a bit of laughter in there that makes me nervous, but it's different to the explainer I gave at the end of last episode. I think, it's because I'm nervous. I think it's just because privilege is a really loaded topic that's been both weaponized and politicized, and even just in attempting to add nuance and build on the concept, even though it's clear that I'm on board with the concept, it still makes me nervous. So thus, there's some nervous laughter here and there. Thanks for bearing with me through that. Afterthought number two. I never quite said this as clearly as I would have liked, so I'm just going to say it again here. When we say that men are privileged, what we really mean is men are privileged in some very specific ways that happen to be the ones valued by patriarchy also, or something like that. Women are privileged in other ways that happen to be in many ways more important and more valuable, or at least important and valuable, don't know about more, but perhaps not important and valuable within the patriarchal model or within the mainstream understanding of privileged. When we talk like men are privileged and that's all there is to it, we sort of skip over that nuance. We make it harder to focus on the things that we need men to have access to so that they become better men, which is in turn better for all of us. So when I say something like, we're all privileged, but in different ways, heavily patterned by our gender, I don't seek to undo or undermine the very legitimate claims that women have been making and are making about the privileges that they want access to. I'm wanting to add to that understanding, not subtract from it, because I believe that that will be better for all. And my third afterthought is that when I was talking us through the analysis of privilege, first we went through it through the lens of race, and then we went through it through the lens of gender. I wasn't as clear on something as I would have liked to have been there either. So, which is that as a white person, it's never been confusing for me, and I've never felt disadvantaged because of my skin. As a male person, however, it's often been confusing for the reasons I went into in this episode. The reason I'm pointing this out is because I want to separate myself from people who want to throw out all understandings of privilege and who deny they have any. In saying what I'm about to say, let's just ignore the fact that I don't identify as a man. I don't identify as any gender, as you know by now. But for these purposes, how I present to the world and the privileges I've got is from that is crucially important. So what I want to say is there are white men who deny that they have any privilege and who want to throw the whole model out the window completely. I am not that person. As you can tell by now, I think privilege awareness and so forth is hugely important. What I've learned is that as a white person, I am more or less at the top of the privilege pile. As a male presenting person, however, I have found that my privilege situation to be much more nuanced. So at times it's an advantage and at times it's a disadvantage. I've never felt that nuance with regards to skin colour or race. So that's my afterthoughts. Thanks, friends. Go well until next time. And remember to share this episode with someone if that feels right.